Welcome to Infendo Radio, the best Nintendo podcast on the English-speaking internet. This is episode 294. My usual co-hosts are not joining me this evening. We were unable to get the Infendo Radio crew together over the holiday season, so we have this special episode for you, which is a pre-recorded episode taken from the Nintendo Show, where I was a guest member. So this is myself and John speaking about The Legend of Zelda: A Link Between Worlds and Mario 3D World on the Wii U. If you like the discussion which goes down in this show, you can hear more from the Nintendo Show by searching for Nintendo Show on iTunes or on your search engine of choice. Hope you enjoy.
Hey everyone, this is John, and this is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. This is the mini show for the month of December, in which we usually just talk about general things we've been playing. It's going to be mostly devoted to Zelda and Mario here. I have a very special guest with me here tonight. Wes couldn't be here, so I brought in someone even better, and that's Lewis Pugh from the Infendo Radio podcast. How you doing tonight, Lewis?
Wow, yeah, I'm doing pretty good, thanks. I'll let you get away with that slogan, because I'm on the show for tonight.
All right, well, we'll see. And I do mean it, though, that you are infinitely better than Wes. That guy, man, unless we're talking about Pokemon, he's useless.
Oh, wow. Does he listen to the show?
I hope so.
The disappointing thing will be when you find out he doesn't mention this.
Oh, yeah, I'm not saying anything now I wouldn't say directly to his face. So, we are going to do a big spoiler cast here for both Mario 3D World and A Link Between Worlds. And I wanted to start off with just kind of getting like some of your opinions about generally what you consider spoilers in games. Because some people like don't want to know any information about games before they go in. Just like as a general opinion, what do you consider spoilers?
I would consider a spoiler anything which would genuinely take you off guard in the game. I mean, a lot of Nintendo games rarely do that nowadays, in terms of genuine things you weren't expecting in terms of story or actual concepts. I'm not saying they're not great, but anything, yeah, you completely wasn't expecting.
Do you think that Reggie spoiled Mario 3D World?
See, I would say no on that one.
I would agree.
Despite him saying so.
Yeah. He didn't reveal anything that I didn't... I would have been super disappointed if I hadn't discovered for myself. You know, top-down levels, speedruns. All right, cool. We knew that there were going to be different types of levels.
And I think the big thing from that was the Rosalina reveal.
Yeah, I think so too.
My opinion on that is if it comes from the horse's mouth, it cannot be a spoiler, even if the person telling you it says it's a spoiler. If it's coming directly from Nintendo about their game before it comes out, it's just new information.
One thing that is hard to spoil, I think, in Nintendo games is the actual story. Yeah. Because guess what? Someone's getting kidnapped by Bowser.
Actually, there wasn't a... technically, a princess wasn't kidnapped.
No, not this time. And I actually got into a verbal argument with someone at work about Bowser always kidnapping Peach, because that's not always the case. And I would, in fact, argue that in less than half of Mario games, Peach is getting kidnapped.
Yeah, I mean, I think 3D World just kind of shows how generous Mario is. I mean, has he even seen these fairy folk before?
Right.
Before he decides to run through these worlds to rescue them?
And he just dives right in, yep.
Yep, he sees them for a couple of seconds at max.
I mean, Bowser could be doing the world a favor.
Yeah.
He's more of a grouch than a villain, I've always thought.
Yeah, we don't know the background between these fairy people.
Anyway, I thought we were going to start with Zelda.
Yeah, we could start with Zelda.
So, the one thing, let's start with the story of Zelda, since we're kind of on that topic. The one thing that I really like about the story of A Link Between Worlds is that it's very minimal. You get very small interactions with a few different characters at the beginning of the game, but in my opinion, this is probably one of the smallest, in terms of scope, story in a Zelda game since like the Game Boy Color games. What'd you think of the story?
I really like how it's being presented. I've not yet completed it, but in terms of how the game gets you going, it's a lot more streamlined than the previous, at least the console Zelda games.
Yeah, I would agree. How far are you?
I've got 2 portraits left.
Okay. Do you know the general location of that portraits? Because I'll stay away from those 2 dungeons.
Well, I'm in the ice ruins currently.
Okay.
Which will be one of those 2.
Yes.
And the other one is the desert sand area in the bottom left.
Oh, that one's so good. that's my favorite one.
I searched around for it, actually, and I had to give up and look for another one. So I didn't want to resort to an FAQ.
Yeah, it requires a lot of flipping back and forth between the worlds. And anyway, I'll stay away from as many spoilers as I can, but I do want to talk about that one in a bit. One of the things that has been a pretty hot topic of conversation for this game is the visual style. And personally, I have no issues or complaints about the visual style or the art direction or Link's sideburns. Did you have any opinion on that?
No, I mean, to be fair, it's one of those portable games which look a lot better on the system than it does in screenshots. Because I wasn't a great fan when I saw the initial screenshots, but yep, just playing it, it just feels like a Link to the Past. They've kind of really nailed that art style.
Yeah, one thing I do like about the visual style is like the small little visual flares that they throw in, like Majora's Mask hanging on the wall and how you can merge into the wall and stand behind it as if you're wearing the mask. One of the really cool things is in Kakariko Village, there are a number of walls that you can merge into inside people's houses, and there's like a picture of those little plant dudes from Wind Waker. I'm going to totally butcher the name, but the Koroks?
Okay,
As well as a portrait of the lobster design on Link's shirt from Wind Waker.
Oh, yeah, I did see that one.
Which I thought was a really cool little detail that they threw in.
Yeah. If anything, I think the kind of the art style of like painting Link almost outshines kind of the retro Link to the Past Link.
Oh, sure. It's got a lot of charm to it.
Yeah. So it made me feel that maybe they should have just done it in a Wind Waker type style. And that would kind of be more seamless between him and Portrait Link. Or I don't know if it's just the contrast between the two. But yeah, just as odd as it sounds, just seeing him kind of wobble across the walls, it's got a lot of charm to it.
Yeah, and I wouldn't mind the Toon Link style for this game either. I mean, whether or not I'd use the Toon Link style doesn't really affect my overall opinion of the game. But I do like Toon Link, and I handles it. Like, I really liked Minish Cap because it kind of used that Toon Link style as well. I thought it worked really well on a handheld.
Yeah.
Did you play in 2D mostly, or did you turn on the 3D quite a bit?
I started off playing it almost exclusively in 3D, but it just kind of the general kind of just kind of playing it like during breaks and such. I was starting playing it on the 2D as well.
Yeah.
But now, when I've got like nice proper section of time to sit down and play that game, yeah, put the 3D slider up all the way.
I can't remember the last time I played a game exclusively in 3D. I generally play mostly in 2D, and sometimes, like during cutscenes and stuff, I'll turn the 3D on. And there are a couple of puzzles in the game where like the platform elevation is a lot easier to define if you turn the 3D on, and I use it there a little bit. But I play almost exclusively in 2D. I got another question for you about your play style. Did you start out renting most items, or did you only rent what you had to and then saved up until you could actually buy the items?
I've been in this cycle of renting items. I've only actually purchased a couple.
Okay. So I took the opposite route, and I rented the ones I had to, and then I waited until they were available for purchase, and then I just started buying. Oh, shoot, there was a follow-up question I wanted. Oh, did you just, like, rent everything at once, or did you, like, take what you needed?
Yeah, no, I was just renting everything at once.
There you go.
I'm not sure that's the smartest way to go through that game, because when you do kind of trip up, as it were, you basically have to spend all the money you had to rent everything.
Yep.
And you seem to kind of almost always have enough to just do that.
It did.
But then you're penniless.
One of the things I did in order to make sure I had enough money to just keep on buying stuff is I spent about 30 or 45 minutes at the beginning of the game just farming bees. Have you gone bee hunting?
No, I've not gone bee hunting, actually. I found a few little kind of exploits to get some money, but I haven't been at the bees.
And I was actually lucky enough, close to the beginning of the game, I think when I first got to low roll, I just happened across a golden bee. Now, there is the store that sells them for, you know, the max amount of rupees that you can have, or you can just luck upon one. I did. And have you found a golden bee yet?
I've not, but this is sounding a bit more like Animal Crossing now.
the golden bee, it's a minor spoiler. I mean, it's insignificant, but you find a golden bee and you bring it to the guy who buys the bees from you, and he gives you a medallion. And that medallion, I think, has two purposes. It only explicitly says one, and that is that it makes bees basically friendly toward you. So the bees won't attack you, but they will zip all across the screen attacking enemies. So it turns your bees into weapons. And I feel like it's also increased the appearance of bees. So I've actually found a couple more golden bees, which, you know, once you find your second bee, you can sell it to him for 300 rupees. So it's a good way to farm for cash if you're just interested in buying everything you can.
Yeah, the other way I found, which is good for farming cash, is the rupee rush mode. Because obviously it's quite easy to exploit if you have a little desk timer next to you, just counting down to 30 seconds.
Right.
Which the game allows.
I did not have a timer next to me, so I actually got frustrated a couple of times, because it reminds me of the Majora's Mask Postman Challenge.
Yes.
And that drove me crazy, because I spent so much money in there just trying to get that heart piece.
But yeah, in the rupee rush mode, you get multipliers depending on how close you are to that 30 seconds. If you get it like under 1 second, I think it times it by three.
Wow.
Any rupees you got.
Nice.
And I think it's within 2 seconds you get times two. So yeah, that's a good way to go.
Yeah, there's
get
a couple cash. Go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, and it varies between the high roll and low roll.
Yeah.
Slightly different versions of that.
There are a couple of like really cool side questy things like that in minigames. One of the side quests that I actually didn't discover until really late in the game, until I had about one portrait left, was something that I had heard about, how you can upgrade your weapons throughout the game, but I never found like the person or monster that upgraded them for you until really late in the game, where you have to bomb that wall, and there's that squid guy, and you have to collect all their little squid babies.
I've still not seen Squid Guy yet.
Oh,
I know of him. I know I need to see him to upgrade my bought items. I know that's why I've got all these kind of monster tails and those things. But
well, actually, those monster tails, I didn't realize this until, you know, just recently as well. The monster tails and stuff you actually bring to the potion shop, and yeah, they make potions for you there out of the monster tails and guts.
Ah,
and so actually, the upgrade system works by you find the squid guy. It's actually I can tell you if you want, or if you want to.
Good. I've kind of heard kind of bits of it.
The general area is north of the lake, kind of near. You remember in A Link to the Past, the item shop that was kind of near the lake and the bridge there?
Yeah, sure.
It's in that general area, slightly to the northeast of that. It's a wall you have to bomb. There's a sign in front of the wall saying, "Do not bomb this wall. There's a powerful monster in there." And the monster, you know, tells you it's lost its babies. It has 100 babies, and they're scattered across Hyrule and Lowrul. How they got to Lowrul, I don't know. But we're not looking for, you know, a story that makes sense. But then once you've talked to that monster, you find the babies in bushes or attached to walls or just kind of lying around or in the water. You have to dive for them. There's a bunch of different locations where you can find them. And it's nice because it brings up an icon on your map. And when you touch the icon, it will tell you how many squid babies are kind of in that general area. So yeah, it makes hunting for them pretty easy. But the one thing that I think could be improved with this little side quest is that I felt like the squids should have been there from the beginning, unless they all just magically got lost when you bomb the door. Like you bomb the door and they all come rushing out like, oh, you've let all the babies free. But it reminds me of the gold Sculptula quest in Ocarina of Time, how you have all these Sculptulas scattered around and you collect them all, And every time you collect 10, you go back to the squid monster and it allows you to upgrade a weapon of your choice. So, another question for you. Do you say Skulltula or Skulltula?
I say Skulltula.
Oh, really? All right. I mean, I always thought it was just kind of like Tarantula, where it's except it's Skulltula. All right, to each his own, I guess. I forgive you. So, do you have any favorite dungeons or any standout dungeons so far?
I think the dungeon I did before I stepped into the Ice Ruins, which was the Dark Palace.
Yes.
I believe it's called. That was a pretty interesting one.
Yeah, the one where you have to use the stealth to enter it.
Yeah, and there's also puzzles involving knocking out the lights as well as actual lighting torches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting twist. And you know, I think for the most part, this game doesn't put too many twists on the way you solve puzzles in dungeons. Because remember how in Skyward Sword, they were trying not to use any of the like light all the torches puzzles.
Yeah.
And for the most part, there weren't a whole lot of puzzles where, you know, you defeat all the enemies and then the door opens either. So they were trying to stay away from some of those conventions. And this game kind of goes back to them a little bit, but not too excessively. I feel like a lot of like the puzzles so far in dungeons are, you know, find the hidden switch underneath the pot. That's being used quite a bit.
I think, if anything, this game probably has kind of the opposite dungeon-type design to Skyward Sword. Just because I remember when playing through Skyward Sword, they would make you use almost every item you had at that point to complete a dungeon, instead of just focusing on the new one. Where these dungeons, because you can tackle them mostly in any order, they focus very heavily on the one you need to get into the dungeon, as well as the painting mechanic.
I agree, and I like that. And I think, you've definitely played, if you're on the ice one and you only have the desert one left, you definitely played the one where you're using the hook shot quite a bit. In fact, is the ice one the one you're using the hook shot?
I haven't done much in the ice one yet. The ice one, you need the fire rods. I'm not sure how frequently you use.
Yes. I remember that one now. The one where you use the hook shot, they do a lot of interesting things with that. Oh, it's the water one.
The water one,
raising lower than which it is a bit of a callback to Ocarina of Time, because that's where you get the hook shot. And I believe in Majora's Mask as well. Do you get the hook shot in the water one there too?
I cannot remember Majora's Mask.
Oh, it's so good.
So, and yeah, even the boss on the water dungeon. Well, I say it's similar to Ocarina, but it's similar to Link to the Past. Also, thinking about it.
Yeah, but they end up using the weapons, and I think more a bigger variety of ways than they have in the past, because they're just exclusively focusing on that one weapon. And it's more than just, you know, find the next place you have to hookshot onto. It's, you know, using the hookshot to pull switches and things like that. My favorite dungeon is the desert one, where you use the sand rod.
Oh, yes. And
I like this one because it mixes both the use of the sand rod with wall merging in some really creative ways. None of the dungeons are really that long. This one is kind of brief as well. But they do a couple of... I'm trying to stay away from spoilers for you. I don't want to give any solutions to puzzles.
I'm just trying to think now. Was that a portrait one, or was that an early one? I've done one with the sand rod.
That was the portrait one. And you end up... actually, getting there is really good as well, because you end up flipping back and forth between Hyrule and Lowrule quite a bit in order to actually access the dungeon.
I'm just thinking I have actually done that one. I'm not sure what the other one is I need to do.
Good. Have you been to Turtle Rock yet?
Yep, I've done that. Okay. That's the water one.
How about the swamp one? Actually, the swamp one was the water one, so you probably...
Yeah.
Anyway, But using like the sand rod to actually build walls and then having to merge onto them, I thought was a really creative way to merge the two, like the ability of the weapon and the ability of Link throughout the game. And I think that dungeon most effectively used both your weapon and your skill as Link.
Yeah, because you even used the sand rod to make like almost a barrier where you can like run past and not be attacked by the lasers.
Yeah, that one really really impressed me with the overall design. And like, Nintendo's kind of on a roll with, if you consider two games a roll, but it's kind of on a roll with the use of those kind of desert sand areas, because the Sand Sea in Skyward Sword I thought was a really impressive area. I enjoyed the Sand Sea from start to finish whenever you had to go into it.
Yeah, I think that was definitely the best location in that game. Because, to be fair, I think mostly the other locations in Skyward Sword were a bit generic.
Yeah, I mean, in Skyward Sword, as long as we're taking a tangent here, I absolutely hated the swimming area when you had to go back to the forest. That got on my nerves. But
yeah.
I kind of liked having to go through the Elden area and re-find all of your items. It kind of reminded me of like the Forsaken Fortress in Wind Waker, except you had more stuff you had to find. And I kind of like that procedural part of it, where like, okay, well, I got to go do this and get my thing back so I can backtrack and bomb this wall and so on and so forth. I really kind of enjoyed that one.
Yeah, just to pardon the pun, put a link between these. It's be good to see Nintendo brings or take some ideas that they've brought in A Link Between Worlds into the next console game.
Yeah.
Whatever form that would shape.
Yeah. So, have any of the bosses of the dungeons impressed you at all?
Yeah, I've been quite impressed with them. I'm actually just quite impressed by the kind of the difficultness of them, at least for myself. I know the I'm saying it about the Dark Palace, the boss in there, it took me a little while to figure out how to kind of take down his final form.
Which one was he?
So he was the one with kind of the armored helmet on his head, and he kind of charges at you.
Oh, yes. I actually have that one written down in my notes.
Okay. Yeah, but at the end, all the lights turn off, and he kind of just rampages with his evil eyes.
Yeah, and he was the one that really impressed me, because, you know, you have to... He was the only one I can remember where you actually have to use your wall merge skill in order to defeat. Because the strategy there is to wait until he charges at you, wall merge, and then he stuns himself by running into a wall.
Actually, was it the I can't remember, was it the Thief's Fortress or something? But I was just trying to think, the dungeon for that one, or the boss for that one, you defeat by merging into its shield, and then when it pulls it back,
right. You
can hop behind it and then start attacking it from behind.
Yeah, that one was really good too.
That was a cool mechanic.
So, and I kind of wish that they had done more of those kind of things where they use your merge ability in order to defeat the boss. Because I feel like in a lot of the dungeons, it follows the formula of you have to use your specific skill. You have to use your fire rod, your ice rod, your hook shot in order to kind of defeat its first form and then just slash away at it in its second form. And I thought it'd been really cool if they could come up with more ways to use that merge skill to take out the bosses.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But I'm very impressed just by the many different uses they managed to find for that merge tool,
in
the overworld or in the puzzles and that side of things.
Yeah, it's really good. And those two boss fights, I mean, I don't mean to say that, you know, the other boss fights were garbage. I was so impressed with the way that they use the merge skill with those two. I kind of want more of it. And I haven't beaten the final boss yet. I'm in the middle of Lorel Castle.
Okay.
So I don't know if they're going to use that merge skill with the final boss. I hope they do.
I imagine they would.
Yeah. So, as far as the boss difficulty curve, you know, quite a few of them have a pretty good challenge to them, but I feel like because they've kind of scattered the dungeons and you do them in any order, there's no real progression of difficulty within the boss fights. Like, if you do one boss at the beginning, it's not going to be any more difficult than the boss you pick at the end. It's all just going to depend on your play style and how you approach bosses, the challenge they're going to give you. Not really a complaint, just kind of an observation, you know, and it's just a symptom of having an open world game like that. It doesn't, they avoided the kind of Zelda NES problem or attribute of the game, where if you did discover dungeon 8 first, you know, you're probably going to die. Whereas in this game, if you go to, you know, what might be considered dungeon 8 at the beginning, you stand a reasonable chance. So, the one thing that they don't do in this game is you don't get unique weapons in each dungeon, but they do replace that with these little upgrades that you can get, pieces to upgrade your sword. You can upgrade your stamina meter, as it were, your magic meter. And then you also find like new tunics, which I thought was pretty cool. It's nice that they are able to still give you those upgrades in dungeons, so you feel like you're progressing and getting more powerful as the game goes on.
Yeah, it is good. But as you said before, it's kind of the only downside I can think of having a more open Zelda, is it seems the difficulty curve gets easier as you get through the game.
Yeah, and I've kind of struggled with that idea, like trying to balance it between, like, do I not like it because I feel like I'm getting all powerful, or do I like it as more of a characterization element of the gameplay where I should be getting more powerful because I'm defeating these bosses and releasing these sages? I think that you can kind of be an apologist for the game in that respect if you wanted to. But, you know, I'm really hoping that the final boss kind of ramps up the difficulty so I get that really big sense of accomplishment. You know, it's not like Resident Evil where I want the final boss to be really easy because I've saved up my Magnum ammo for so long. I kind of want this guy to put up a fight.
Yeah, and there's no kind of reason not to as well. I mean, obviously, you can only get to that final dungeon once you've done all the others, so they can assume that you've completed all of them and you're ready for the final challenge in terms of difficulty.
One thing we have touched on quite a bit as we've been talking here is the wall merging. And one thing I don't think we have discussed too much is how it affects the exploration, you know, throughout the overworld and throughout the dungeons. And I really like the way it kind of opens up the places you can go that you wouldn't think that you would be able to go. Like if there's a big boulder in your way, you can merge onto the wall and move right past it. And a lot of times, most items aren't required for just maneuvering around the world. And within the dungeons as well, there's quite a few dungeons where the items that you find aren't, they're crucial, but they're not the main focus of the puzzle in the game. Where the one where you have to use bombs, the bomb dungeon, I can't remember which one that was, but that one specifically was a dungeon where I found myself merging onto walls more often than actually using bombs, which was nice. It was a nice change of pace to use that new skill.
And that was the Dark Palace, thinking about it.
Yes. So, and not only that, but it adds like a new perspective to a couple of dungeons. I think this is before you go to Lowrul, but the one dungeon where you're moving outside of the dungeon quite a bit.
Yeah, for thinking back on it, I'm not sure they're going to touch on that again later, but it seems odd that they haven't done that since.
Yeah, they did that the one time.
Yeah, and that was a really fantastic use, going like from inside to outside of the dungeon. And yeah, seeing that dungeon in a completely new way.
Yeah, maybe at Lowrul Castle, because yeah, they didn't really attempt it again. So,
but no, I'm impressed of how it lets you explore the overworld. If I'm being picky, although it's more so that it's given me different chances to explore, is if I ever go off to I come out to a little kind of step outside of a cliff or whatever, and I see a wall can be moved across on the picking mode, I will just go as far as I can to my bar runs out just to make sure there isn't some silly little chest hidden away somewhere, and often like just fall down and have to find my way back.
Yeah, I've been there too.
Yeah, but sometimes you do happen to go inside like a little cave and you find this like a treasure chest, 100 rupees or something, and it's just nice that it kind of rewards you for exploration in that way, going out your way.
They do some really creative things with walking along the walls throughout the overworld. I remember specifically having to flip back and forth between Hyrule and Lowrul and having to walk across several walls to find that guy that you're supposed to deliver the milk to. Have you done that side quest yet?
No, I haven't.
There's a side quest where there's a guy lost in the mountains, and of course, you know, if you give him some milk, he'll be re-energized and be able to make his way down. And that's how you get one of the empty bottles. And it requires so much flipping back and forth between Hyrule and Lowrul and walking along walls. I spent probably a good 30 or 45 minutes just trying to figure it out. And a couple of times I just kind of rage quit the section and I ended up walking around with this bottle of probably spoiled milk. until I finally found him.
Talking about the milk, I have been in the milk bar itself, and it brings up a very cool point about the game, where if you go to the back of the milk bar, you can speak to someone who will play different renditions of old Zelda tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
And they sound really good. So you can waste plenty of time just requesting different tracks and enjoying them on a nice pair of headphones.
I'm doing that more now that I have all of my items bought. At the beginning of the game, I walked in and I was like, oh, I'm going to go back there and listen to music. And like, hey, pay us 20 rupees. I was like, no, I'm not paying you 20 rupees. I need these things.
Yeah.
But now I'm not quite as stingy. So, another thing that really impresses me with the exploration within dungeons is the vertical progression that has become more of an element with this game. Not only in like the hammer dungeon at the very beginning, but in a few different dungeons, there's an emphasis on vertical progression rather than just lateral progression. Not only like are there like the first floor, the second floor, and the third floor, but there's also like different layers on each floor. I'm thinking specifically of Turtle Rock, where there are a couple of like floors that actually have, I guess, a couple stories to them, because there's a door down low, a door up high, and there are a couple of times doors in between that. So it's using that vertical space more than other 2D Zeldas have in the past.
Yeah, I also think this game makes good use of the different floors interacting with each other in terms of a more globalized puzzle throughout the dungeon.
Yeah, there's, was it the Dark Palace dungeon that requires you to drop down holes?
So you make holes in the floor, as it were, so a beam of light can eventually shine down to the very first floor.
Yep.
But there's obviously puzzles in the water dungeon as well for the different water levels, and I believe that works across the different floors as well. There's two different sets of water levels, if I can remember correctly.
Shoot, I lost my train of thought. Oh, the Dark Palace dungeon. I wanted to ask you, did you have as hard a time as I did trying to get to that big chest that contained the piece of ore to upgrade your sword?
I did, yes.
That was so obtuse.
Yeah, I can't remember why it caused me so much hassle in the end, but I could just keep seeing it on the map and just trying to work out how to get there.
Well, yeah, and it used these two switches that also had different uses. So you use those two switches to like progress through the room. You're like, okay, I'm done with these switches. And I actually had to go to a GameFAQs to find how to get to, actually, I think I went to the Miiverse to find how to get to that treasure chest, because you had to like place a bomb by the lower one, go up and hit the top one while you're staying on the platform, raise up and merge onto the wall before your bomb exploded. And oh man, that gave me such a headache trying to figure out how to do that. One little gripe that I did have, and I have this gripe with almost every Zelda game, so it's not a huge deal, is that some of the tools you don't really have that much of an opportunity to use. Things like the Tornado Rod. You used it in its one dungeon, and I haven't found another use for it yet.
I noticed it made the Water Dungeon a lot easier as well.
Huh. There's the chest with the
dungeon key in it, or the boss key, is covered with fire.
Oh yes.
And I can't remember, I'm not sure what the puzzle is to complete that, but I just thought, I wonder
you
if this will work.
You use it to put out the fire.
Yeah, and I just did that, and it went straight into the boss door.
Oh, that would have been such less of a hassle. That's good thinking. Oh, and also the bow. I have not used the bow hardly at all.
Which is quite surprising for Zelda, really.
Yeah, it hasn't really been used to solve any puzzles. I can't think of a dungeon that's solely focused on the bow. I did use it more in the beginning of the game when I was trying to keep enemies at bay, specifically ones that had shields, before my sword had been upgraded and stuff. But
something we haven't mentioned yet is how the game doesn't use the traditional consumable items. So it's all now just kind of one energy bar or one magic bar. I can't remember how they define it. But any item you use, whether it's a bow and arrow, bombs, and so on, they just drain this single bar down and then it recharges over time.
And I think that adds a greater... Let me put it this way. It makes it easier to manage your inventory because you're not always worried about, okay, well, now I got to go chop some bushes and find some more bombs or arrows. But not only does it make managing your inventory easier, it also adds a bigger challenge when you're in a more heated battle. For example, in the dungeon that used the ice rod, where you had to defeat the wizard robes, sometimes they'll get you pretty surrounded, or you're on a platform that's going to lower into lava, so you have to aim your ice rod in the correct spot, but also make sure you have enough, I guess, stamina or ammunition in your bar in order to use it effectively.
Yeah, no, I quite like that. It's, I think, just another little element which kind of streamlined the game from previous games.
Yeah. So, we talked a little bit about the overalls. I'm just scanning through my notes here. Oh, have you filled up your inventory? Do you have all the boxes full?
No, not yet.
I don't know that you can,
Oh.
because, yeah, I have. I bought all the items. I got the bug net, the torch, the hint glasses, five empty bottles. But I don't know, like, unless there's some side items you can collect, like, just through hidden areas throughout the game, I don't know that you'll be able to fill them all up.
Yeah, I've got quite a few spaces, so I'm not sure if you can. But what that does kind of remind me of is the quip system.
Yeah.
So this is another first in the Zelda game, I believe. So out of your allotted items, you can kind of draw a little box around a certain group of them, and then you can cycle through them by tapping the item button on your touchscreen, and then actually, I can't remember what button you then use to kind of cycle through them. But you can do that instead of jumping into the item menu. To be fair, I haven't really used it too much, but it's a nice little option to have.
Yeah, neither have I. And I feel like that would be a really, really useful feature in a Zelda game that is more focused on the use of your tools. But this game focuses so much on your merge ability that, you know, you're using basically one or two items throughout the dungeon, so cycling through isn't really all that necessary or useful. But I would like to see that in other Zelda games where, you know, they're using multiple items or dungeons, like it would have been really great in Skyward Sword.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Skyward Sword did have a good system, but thinking about it, it in theory would work really well for the Wii U game, because you're not always looking at your gamepad screen
Yeah.
to just be able to equip your items, without having to look down and drag and drop. That
Right.
would come in handy, especially in battle.
It would work really well with a Majora's Mask remake because you could have your quick equip for your items and then the touchscreen for all your masks.
That would work well.
That's something that I bring up quite a bit on my podcast. How awesome a
Oh, sorry, I do think Majora's Mask would go to 3DS though.
I
As
know.
much as I would like to see it in HD.
Oh, it's disappointing. I mean, I
Yeah.
wouldn't be disappointed with a Majora's Mask remake, but man, it would be so good on the Wii U.
No, I agree, but they just got that engine there from Ocarina.
Yeah, it just makes so much sense to put on the 3DS if they are going to do one because it reuses so many assets from Ocarina of Time.
Exactly. So since they've put at least some effort into making 3DS versions of all those models in Ocarina, they're going to reuse all of them anyway. So, yeah, I reckon that's going to hit 3DS when it does. But
Yeah.
I would be pleasantly surprised, or yeah, I would definitely wouldn't complain if it was for the Wii U.
So, speaking of reusing assets, Hyrule, I've heard people saying that it's an exact replica of the Super Nintendo Hyrule.
It's close.
It's close, but it's not exactly there. There's a couple of routes you could take that used to be closed off in A Link to the Past. I'm thinking specifically of south of the castle. You used to not be able to move west toward Kakariko in A Link to the Past, but now that there's some trees that have been moved out of the way for easier travel.
So yeah, we heard since that this game actually started as an actual just a like a recreation of A Link to the Past,
Yeah.
and then partway through development they decided to make it a sequel instead, so they can bring some new ideas into it. So I guess that kind of explains why it's as close as it is, but with the new mechanics, that the painting mechanic on its own, it just kind of has a breath of fresh air for the whole thing. The fact that you can have all this almost 2D bit where you can slide across the walls, wrap around, and go to completely different areas you couldn't before. I think that makes it all worthwhile.
Yep. One thing that I did want to also bring up is that navigating through Lorule is a lot different because you have this fragmented world where there's chasms that split up sections of the game. So you have to cross between Hyrule and Lorule in order to access those areas. And it works just fine. I don't really have any complaints about it. I think it would be kind of nice if maybe through beating dungeons, you could connect areas between each other so that you can just move throughout the world, because it feels so good to move throughout the world, both Hyrule and Lorule in this game, that it would be kind of nice just to kind of walk around Lorule and look for squid babies or heart pieces or secrets or something, to not have to worry about warping between weather veins, which it is. It is nice that they have the weather veins so available so early in this game. It makes, like, if you want to get from one place to another really quickly, it makes it really, really easy. But it would be kind of cool if you could just kind of unite Lorule and have one big area to move through.
No, I do agree with you, but I'm just happy to have that weather vane system and introduced as early as it was.
Yeah, no question. So let's bring this discussion, this very long discussion of Link Between Worlds, to a close with this. How do you think this stacks up against other portable Zelda games?
Ooh, good question. Against the portable ones, it's definitely up there. It's aiming to be my second favorite portable Zelda game.
Okay. What would you put above it?
I mean, it's probably hugely nostalgic factors in this, but Link's Awakening.
Okay, well, that's actually one that I was replaying just before this came out, and yeah, that one, man, what a classic. I'm trying to get out of the habit of ranking games like that because there's so many different factors between, you know, why you like one more than another. But this one is actually shaping up to be quite a favorite of mine. I really like the portable Zelda games. Link's Awakening, I think, might be at the top, but I also really like Minish Cap. I think that one's a little bit underrated. I think that's a really great game. And Oracle of Ages is that one might be up there with Link's Awakening as well, because I really love Oracle of Ages. It's one of the first portable Zelda games I played. That's probably a big factor, because my first portable was a Game Boy Color, and Oracle of Ages was the first game I had for it.
Yeah, on my scale, Oracle Ages is underneath Minish Cap, which is underneath probably this and then Awakening.
They're all so good, though.
Yeah.
Let me add an addendum to that statement. They're all so good, except the DS ones. I really don't like those.
Yeah, I never really got into these DS games.
So, but A Link Between Worlds, I really like it. It's really briskly paced. You can move throughout the world really quickly. The dungeons don't take 2 hours like they did in Skyward Sword and Twilight Princess, which is fine for a console game, but for a handheld, it's nice that these dungeons are smaller. And it gives you a lot of freedom to explore and move throughout the world from beginning to end.
Yeah, and it definitely just captures not only the Link to the Past feel, but just kind of Zelda in general. As soon as you start that game, you feel right at home, and you've got nice, fresh, and interesting things as well.
Yep. So, on that note, should we move into Mario 3D World?
Yeah, certainly. So, two worlds.
Yep. And actually, I have a couple of notes scattered here that we'll touch on, but These two games share a couple of things in common. Well, let's start with 3D World, where we started with Zelda, and that is the story, which is nearly non-existent. And that's really what I love about Nintendo games, is that, sure, Bowser's around, something's kidnapped, go get him. But you don't want to play the game because you want to rescue the little fairy creatures in the bottle. You want to play the game because it's just fun to move throughout the game and throughout the levels. And in Nintendo games, you know, more than most other games that I've played, the journey is what's important and not the destination.
Of course, yeah. The Mario intros at this point are just a bit like pantomime. And thinking back on it, it's quite good. They don't even use a single text word explaining the story of 3D World. And probably all Mario games. But yeah, it's just all kind of acted out. And you know what you're doing.
Is the last time we had text in a Mario game? Mario World. Mario 64, where Peach has baked a cake. I don't know, there was probably something in Sunshine.
I was thinking in Sunshine there was voice acting. Not for Mario himself, but for the other characters.
So, this game, it looks great. It's really bright and colorful, everything you want from a Mario game. It has really awesome remixes. Both 3D World and A Link Between Worlds have really awesome remixes of classic music. The one thing that stood out to me the most about the music is something really small, and it's the death chime. And it's the death chime from Super Mario 3 rather than almost every other Mario game that they use.
Yeah. Well, I guess they do it for the different characters as well.
Do they have different death chimes per character?
I'm just thinking of them. Oh, no, maybe they don't.
That would be interesting. I mean, I primarily play as Mario, so...
Actually, yeah, I was going to ask you. Have you kind of tested all the different characters?
I have.
And is it Mario you keep going back to?
Yeah, because I like the balance that he brings throughout moving the levels. I mean, some levels you have to replay as different characters if you want to collect everything. Yeah. But I like playing as Mario because he's just kind of a jack-of-all-trades, master of none. Except when I'm trying to do a speedrun or beat someone's ghost, I switch to Toad.
Yeah. I think Toad is probably my most played character. If I wasn't so kind of determined not to just go with the standard Mario, I probably would have just gone with Mario because he just kind of feels right in this game. But yeah. out of the other three, Toad is my favorite. Oh, yeah. That speed boost.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, Peach just feels real slow, and Luigi's always running on ice, so...
Yeah, I was hoping to really like Peach, but that float jump of hers seems to be really decreased in the actual time she can float for. So it seems to be a couple of seconds and that's it.
Yeah. Actually, I was playing a co-op quite a bit when I first got the game with my friend Ryan, who's been on the show a couple of times. And he played primarily as Peach. And he remarked the same thing because he's got this funny little quirk where he plays as Peach in everything that he can. Mario Party, Super Mario 2, yeah, Peach is his go-to character. And one of the first things he said is like, wow, her float doesn't really last very long.
Yeah, maybe he's an avid Peach Smash player.
He absolutely is. Yes.
Oh, okay. Because she can float for a huge amount of time in that game.
Yep. But one thing that I do like about this game is that it offers a really good challenge. Like, the lives in most Mario games are plentiful, but they're also necessary. So at the beginning of the game, when we were playing a co-op, we were burning through a good amount of lives. Because we're getting, not only we're getting used to the game, but it can get pretty hectic. And the level design doesn't really take it easy on you. Like, and when you're getting later into the game, you're thankful that you have all those lives because the difficulty definitely ramps up.
Yeah, also, I think you definitely end up losing more lives in the multiplayer mode. And I don't think it's just because there's more people to lose lives. I'm not sure if it's because the camera pans out or whatnot, or it's just you kind of play more casually when you're playing with your friends. But yeah, I find when playing single player, my amount of lives kind of skyrocket up. And when I'm playing multiplayer, they start to shoot down.
Yeah, and plus it's easier to use those live exploits when you're playing single player because nobody cares if you're spending the whole time just jumping on a turtle shell over and over again. They're not begging you to continue on. You can just rack up as many lives until your heart's content.
Yeah, and saying that, I quite like the multiplayer system of the points and the crown.
Oh, yes.
Also being the steal that from people or picking up it when it's fallen.
It's like you're reading my notes. That was what I was going to say next. Excellent. Yeah. We got into a bit of a competition because at first it was like, yeah, let's just play the game. We're having fun. But I would consistently have more points than him. And it would get to the point where he would move throughout the level trying to do things that would get him points. And I would just barely edge him out every time. And he would get so frustrated, you know, in a friendly way. And just try his damnedest to beat my high score every time.
So it makes things like the green stars, even if you've already completed them previously, it makes them so important to collect them in multiplayer mode because you get such a big boost in points.
Yeah, it turns the game into something that I'm gonna use a phrase that you coined in your most recent podcast, the Infendo Radio podcast. It's a counter cooperative game where you have a common goal, but there's this point system that creates this tension among the other players. While you're still trying to get your common goal, you're trying to do it just a little bit better than everybody else.
Yeah, and you can also kind of physically step in, and you can still pick up each other, and you can jump on each other and so on like that. And if one person has the crown in the group, it just makes a very interesting social gameplay there.
Yeah, the fact that you can steal the crown is something I neglected to tell him while we were playing the game, and that's probably what just barely edged me out every time that I would win.
Yeah,
the fact I completed the level with the crown.
But get the crown bonus.
He's probably listening, so now he knows.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the green stars, and I really like going throughout the game and getting all the collectibles, the green stars and the stamps. Do you ever use the stamps in that there Miiverse?
I think I've used a stamp once as a stamp, but I do like collecting them.
Yeah, I can't remember one time that I've posted a little comment box with stamps in it, but this game is just really fun to go get everything.
Yeah, no, it's good to have all those collectibles. And even though I've only used one once, I like the idea of a functional collectible, especially one in every single level of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... I can't remember another Mario game where the collectibles also have a function to them, other than, you know, like, collect all these stars in order to unlock the next door.
Yeah.
But, like, an application actually outside the game, that's something really cool they've added in.
Yeah, and I've got a feeling we're going to see stamps more often in other Wii U games.
I hope so. It's fun.
Then have we heard any announcements of any other games which have stamps, or is it it's just 3D World so far?
Not that I'm aware.
Yeah.
But we better tell Harrison to watch his Miiverse post, because that he posted something where...
Oh, yes.
It was the green pipe and the two coins, suspiciously phallic looking.
Hmm.
People get banned for that.
Yes, they do.
Some of the collectibles are quite well hidden throughout the game. I know one level specifically I'm having a hard time with is, I think, level 4-5. I can't seem to find that middle green star. And I've posted on the Miiverse looking for help, but nobody, maybe nobody wants to help. I don't know.
Yeah, the actual kind of where the green stars are throughout the levels. There seems to be a good selection of tricky ones. There seems to be quite a lot of challenge in finding these green stars, especially after you got over the kind of the first couple of worlds.
Yeah, and there's so many, because there's so much content to this game. There are just a ton of levels and, you know, green stars to collect in each one. How far have you gotten?
I'm on the 8th world currently.
Okay, well, there's... I don't want to spoil too much, but there's
you can spoil. I've heard there's quite a lot of post game content.
Oh yeah, there's quite a bit more. I think after the 8th world, I think like levels 1 through 8 are the only levels with stamps in them. But then there's a lot more levels that open up with more green stars to get.
Oh, brilliant!
Yeah, no, this is definitely one I'm going to be trying to play to completion over the next couple of days. So the level variety is also really good. I'm very impressed with the different types of levels they can get in there. And, you know, not only like the speed runs and the Mario Kart ones and like the top-down shooter ones that they've shown before, but just like the normal regular levels try so many different things, such as like having to move vertically a lot more than in previous like 3D Mario games, like in the Mario Galaxy games. There's a lot more of that vertical progression where you have to explore upwards in order to progress throughout the level.
Yeah, I'm surprised we've actually made it. I don't want to spoil the flow of the show here, but we've made it so far talking about 3D World without discussing the cat suit yet.
That's true, yeah, and the cat suit adds a lot to that vertical
exactly.
exploration.
Yeah, and obviously the cat suit can help a lot in getting some of those green stars. But yeah, I think it's because of the... Well, I guess because of the cat suit, and I guess a couple of the other power-ups, because they've also brought back the propeller suit.
Yeah, the little box that you can get.
Yeah, helps you, you know, climb vertically throughout the levels.
And one of the things that, again, this is something that it has in common with A Link Between Worlds, is that exploration along that vertical axis, where a lot of other 3D platformers, you know, since the dawn of 3D platformers, has been the exploration of, like, the depth and the width of the game, and not a whole lot moving across that vertical axis. And A Link Between Worlds does that, you know, within dungeons and moving along different layers of the walls or different height of the walls. And this game does it, you know, with climbing the walls with the cat suit.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, some very good uses out of the verticality. One thing I did think was a bit bizarre was one of the levels which was set up very much like 3D Land, and I think it was one of the levels with the propeller suit, and you're kind of hopping from one bit to the next, but the camera is kind of straight above you looking down, and it was one of the types of stages which benefited greatly with the stereoscopic 3D, which this game doesn't have.
Obviously. I don't remember that one.
Yeah, no, I thought it was really out of place when I saw it. I can't remember if it was like a level off the beaten track or not, but or it was just a portion of a regular level.
What do you think of one thing I also really like about the level variety is that, you know, you have your standard levels where you're progressing from the beginning to the end, but then you also have different types of levels, like the Captain Toad levels and the levels where it puts you in a small room and you have to pull off some sort of feat of platforming within like 10 seconds and grab a green star before progressing to the next area.
Yeah, I like both of those ideas. So the Captain Toad one, where you control a non-jumping toad around, and so it's kind of like a puzzle game. Actually playing them, I was kind of hoping, I don't know if they happen post-game or not, that there's just some more of it. Because there's kind of, what, one per world?
Yeah.
And you get five green stars from him. They're really cool, but they don't last super long, and there's not many of them. But it breaks up the game.
Yeah, and in some of the later levels, it's like 10 per. And the 10 green stars per little challenge level makes it really fun, because if you mess up, then you got to go all the way back to the beginning.
Yeah. I'm not sure I've got to a 10 one yet. I remember a recent one I played was the Ghost House one.
Oh,
that
yeah.
was really fun.
Oh, do you remember the Ghost House where... You think you're at the end and you jump for the flagpole and it turns into a bunch of ghosts?
Yeah.
Oh, that was so good. Well done, Nintendo. That was amazing. So, one other thing that I do like about the levels is that they don't strictly adhere to the sort of elemental motifs of the world. Like, you don't have all sand levels in the desert. You don't have all fire levels in the lava area. And I kind of wonder why they decided to do, like, hey, this is Sky World and this is Desert World in this game, because most of the time the levels aren't, you know, adhering to that. It's just, you know, hey, here's a bunch of really fun levels, and some of them might, you know, be related to the sky in some way.
Yeah, they're very loosely based off their themes, which is a good thing in my opinion.
Yeah, me too. I like that they weren't strictly held down by that formula in this game. When I first got to the second world, I was like, oh, great, world two is a sand world again. And as I'm playing through the levels, like, this doesn't feel like a desert. This is kind of nice that they're breaking my expectations.
And didn't the sand world also have that silhouette stage?
Yes. Yes.
That was a great way to shake that up.
Yes, indeed. There's a couple more as you get into the later levels, and I think some of the post-game content has a couple silhouette levels. And, yeah, those are really fun. So... Yeah. They do make some good use of some of the boss fights they have that actually make good use of platforming. Like the Bowser Kart level has some pretty good platforming in it, where you're chasing behind him and you have to avoid obstacles. Then also the snake boss, where you have to climb up the snakes and jump on the enemy's head. Make some good use of your platforming and cat climbing skills.
That's the boss which has the best music in the game.
Yes. Agreed. And I really like that some of these bosses actually make use of your platforming skills. And, you know, there's, of course, some other bosses who are just, you're put into an arena and you got to jump on their head three times. And you know, I really wish that they would do more of those bosses just based on platforming, because it's a platforming game, and I want the boss fights to test my platforming skills, not my skills of jumping on enemies' heads. The analogy that I kind of put in my notes here is that it's like having an FPS where then you have a boss fight where you have to solve a Professor Layton puzzle. That's not really the game. The boss fight doesn't fit the rest of the game.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite tricky in theory. I can't think of a very good platforming boss, purely because what's good about a platformer isn't the combat.
Yeah.
It is making, you know, traversing over tricky terrain and using, you know, interesting techniques. But yeah, it's not really about the combat. So I can't think of a great shining example of where it's, you know, the platforming is used to defeat the boss.
I think the most memorable Mario boss fight that I have is actually the boss of New Super Mario Bros. Wii, when you fall into the lava, or Bowser falls into the lava, and you kind of fall in after him, and he becomes like a Giga Bowser, and he's chasing you and breaking bricks behind you, and you have to platform along this section of bricks just in order to get to the end.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good way to do it, because it's a non-combat setting, and it kind of heavily focuses on your platforming skills.
Yeah, and that one, it was made double hectic, because me and Wes were playing that at the same time the first time I got to that boss fight. So there were quite a few obscenities being screamed and quite a bit of panicking going on, but we managed to make it through on the first try. It was just a really satisfying boss fight because of just the hecticness of it and the way it kind of puts your skills with that propeller suit to the test. Any other things you wanted to bring up about Mario 3D World?
I'll mention that I appreciate the range of controller support in this game.
Oh, sure.
I think it uses every combination that you can play. So I like to see Nintendo doing that.
Yeah, which is nice.
Like shunting the classic controller or something like that.
Do you have a controller preference?
To be fair, I normally end up using the gamepad, but from what you play, I like the idea that, you know, player two can use the pro controller instead of, because I own one, you know, and so you're not having to use a Wii remote like what the situation was with New Super Mario Bros. U when it launched.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I also use the gamepad quite a bit, and when my gamepad is running low on battery and I still want to play, I switch to the Wii remote nunchuck. I think that's also a really good setup, but the gamepad, there's those levels where you have to blow into the microphone, which, yeah. Nintendo, if you're listening, can we please, can we put a rest to that, blowing to the microphone mechanic? Because
I don't understand why it's in there.
I don't know. It feels silly at this point. But I'm wondering if, like, how those levels are supposed to function when you have a Wii remote and nunchuck set up. Like, there's no microphone on the Wii remote.
It won't let you play them.
I guess so.
Yeah, no, I tried it. I was playing with the Pro Controller initially, and on one of the levels where you need to use the touchscreen to, you know, interact with the platforms that come out the walls, it basically says you need a gamepad to play this level.
Okay.
Before you begin.
All right. Well, I guess that answers that question.
Yeah, and that's when I kind of switched over as the gamepad as my proper controller, because I thought I might as well use the controller, which can play every level in the game.
Yep. All right, well, let's finish things off with a question I'm going to pose to you here.
Yeah, sure.
Would, for the next Mario game, because you know there's going to be another one, would you rather see Super Mario 3D World 2 or Super Mario Galaxy 3? Or some other variation?
If it's out of one of those two, it would be Galaxy 3.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because, you know, I'm currently playing 3D World now. If we had no choices of anything new, I'd rather them flip between one and the other.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, yeah, Galaxy is a different type of platformer.
Yeah.
So it'd be good to jump back into one of those and, well, the graphics would also look pretty amazing on the Wii U.
That's true.
But I would like them to see them go off in a more Mario 64 Sunshine direction.
Ah, it's like you're reading my notes again.
But I don't think they're going to, which is a little bit saddening.
Yeah, I'm actually going to disagree, respectfully, of course, in that if the choice were between 3D World 2 and Galaxy 3, I kind of want to see what else they can do if they're just being crazy creative like they were in 3D World 2. Maybe if they were to do some downloadable content with like some level packs, that would be really cool. But yeah, I'm 100% with you on that. I'd like to see another Super Mario 64 type game with like a really interactive hub world, much more so than like in the Super Mario Galaxy games, like hub worlds that you actually alter in order to access more levels. I'd like to see more levels where it's not just based on getting from the beginning to the end, but more open-ish levels where there are different goals that you need to accomplish. Another thing that I would really like to see in that same vein is that if they are going to do big open levels with multiple stars to collect, I would like it if you could collect multiple stars in one go-through, where it's like, find all the red coins and get the star, and then you get kicked out.
Yeah. I agree with you there.
All right, my other baby's getting cranky, so I think it's time to draw this to a close. So, thanks for joining me here, Lewis.
Nah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, it's been a good time. Hopefully we'll be able to do it again soon.
I'm sure we can think of something.
So, thanks for listening, everybody.